Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 402, titled Pincers Movement, being recorded on March 9th of 2003. Before I begin the main body of the broadcast, let me remind you there will be a detailed annotated article-length description of For the Record 402 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week or so of the airing of this program. Spitfire website, equipped with real audio, is spitfirelist.com. Also, sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on real audio. More recent programs streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, DaveEmory. Older programs at a longer URL that is linked to both the For the Record section of the Spitfire website and to the other WFMU URL. By the way, tapes or CDs are provided to radio stations free of charge. Contact Spitfire at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. In this program, we're going to be focusing largely on links between the white supremacist and far-right element in the Western world and the Islamist movement, and in turn we're going to be analyzing connections between the Al-Qaeda / Al-Taqwa Muslim Brotherhood milieu and organized crime, and between the Islamists or Islamofascists from abroad and white supremacists and Nazis from within, with organized crime acting as something of a go-between or as something of a conduit whereby terrorists can not only derive money but perhaps infiltrate the United States. The combination of attack from without and attack from within could be considered in some way as a classic pincers movement, hence the title of the program. But before I get to the main body of the broadcast, I want to read an article that I think is worth sharing, and in particular at this point in time, by the way, being March 9th of 2003. Research credit on this goes to a member of the listening audience who got this from the Chicago Sun-Times, and in turn, this article was penned by Chicago Sun-Times columnist Robert Novak, who, along with his late colleague Roland Evans, were longtime staples of the conservative press in the United States. So in evaluating what you're about to read, understand this is not coming from some carping liberal or leftist or any of the other people any of the other labels that might be applied to someone who is saying what Mr. Novak has said. And this certainly couldn't be ascribed to a conspiracy theorist, unquote. With that introduction, consider the following. This is from the Chicago Sun-Times of March 6, 2003. This is from their website at www.suntimes.com. Full URL will be in the description for the show. This, again, from March 6, 2003, Robert Novak printed a column titled, Playing Texas Poker, Bush Bets All on Iraq. This will speak for itself. A senior Bush official privately admits what his administration cannot declare publicly. The stagnant economy, a dagger aimed at the heart of George W. Bush's second term, will not immediately respond to the president's economic growth program. The economic engine will not be revived until the war against Saddam Hussein is launched and won. Military victory is anticipated inside the Bush administration as the tonic that will prompt corporation officers and private investors to unleash the American economy's dormant power. Although it is impolitic to say so, the fact that the United States will be sitting on a new major oil supply will stimulate the domestic economy. That puts a high premium on quickly gaining control of Iraq's oil wells before they can be torched, a major uncertainty in an otherwise strictly scripted scenario. Quote, this is Texas poker with the president putting everything on Iraq, unquote, a Republican senator who thoroughly approves of this policy told me. The extraordinary gamble by Bush leads to deepening apprehension by Republican politicians as they wait for the inevitable war. They consider the Democratic Party divided, drifting to the left, and devoid of new ideas. Yet Bush's re-election next year is threatened by two issues, the economy and the war on terrorism. Success on both is tied to the war with Iraq. Robert Novak concludes his column, skipping down. The senator who told me the president is playing Texas poker is delighted to march with Bush in a crusade for democracy in the Arab world, a goal that colleagues well-versed in diplomacy view as unrealistic. That is the heart of George W. Bush's gamble, with his presidency and the course of the nation at stake. Indeed, basically the ultimate wag-the-dog scenario. Many people have noted what Robert Novak, to his great credit, has taken the time and mustered the courage to print, and that in a major daily, too. As I've said before, I don't think Bush has any domestic agenda whatsoever, and that's basically what's indicated by that column. The Articles 1 reads about what will actually take place militarily in Iraq. Basically, you can flip, and some say that this will be a walkover, that the high-tech superiority of the U.S. and British forces is such, and the demoralized nature of the Iraqi military is such, that it'll be a cakewalk, with people viewing them as liberators. Others say that Iraqi nationalism will be a dominant element. Who knows? Flip them. And likewise with the petroleum situation, even though Iraq has the second largest proven petroleum reserves, a number of people have suggested that ratcheting up Iraqi oil production, even if the oil wells don't get torched, will not be a relatively easy or fast process. Others say, yes, it will. Do not know. But I think that that article speaks for itself. And again, I think that the Bush administration's cynicism is frankly consummate, with, as one columnist noted in the San Francisco Chronicle, the military and the people in it are basically being used rather like the harpooners were manipulated by Captain Ahab in Moby Dick, with Saddam Hussein in a sense being George Bush's Moby Dick, and the military being the good and humble harpoonists who ultimately, to a certain extent at least, will be sacrificed for Ahab's crusade. Now, to the main subject of the program, namely the theory or the stratagem of a pincers movement. Now, the information I'm going to be presenting here is very complicated and predicated. Well, not that the information is complicated, but the hypothesis I'm advancing is part of the long hypothesis that I've been developing for many years, and the hypothesis to which I've devoted hours and hours of programming and hundreds of pages of documentation on the Spitfire website, namely the notion that September 11th and the events around it are a continuation of World War II, that the United States is facing destruction or subjugation by an underground Reich, literally a Third Reich gone underground at the end of World War II and perpetuated in mafia-like fashion, and that the underground Reich has been using economic pressure and a Muslim fundamentalist or Islamo-fascist milieu, and what we're going to be talking about, to basically destroy the United States, or if not to actually physically destroy it, to so sap its resources as to ultimately put it in a position of economic subordination. What we're going to be looking at in this program is the dovetailing between far-right slash Nazi slash white supremacist elements, something we've dealt with in the past, and Islamist elements as well. And one of the things to consider, and as we talked about this in For the Record 399, titled The Serpent's Diaries, is considering on the one hand the white supremacist or domestic fascist milieu with the foreign Islamo-fascist milieu, and utilizing connections that in many ways go all the way back to World War II. I think that we are looking at a culmination of World War II. A continuation of World War II, hopefully not the culmination that the underground Reich wishes. But again, I believe that the Bush administration is the point element for an underground Reich. I also think that many of the people in it are not conscious agents at all, but really are rather like the French elite in the pre-World War II and early World War II period. They're quite willing to party on and to basically exchange a 60 or 70% interest for a 40% interest and let the fascists manage things while they dissipate themselves. I would recommend to people the book Blinded by the Right by David Brock, a right-wing journalist who launched the Clinton scandals industry and then subsequently recanted. And he's written a book that is now out in paperback about the Republican right-wing attack machine. And it's a very revealing book, and I would describe them rather like the – it reads rather like a description of Romans as portrayed in a Cecil B. DeMille movie where you see dissipate Roman elite next to the emperor at the Colosseum. Anyway, read that, and that'll give you an idea about the Bush administration, what we are facing in terms of a terrorist/military assault, a major component of the underground Reich's attack on the U.S. and democracy, is in some ways exemplified by a fellow named Kirk Lyons. Kirk Lyons is an Aryan Nations attorney. A very important and very scary article about Kirk Lyons was researched for us by a member of the listening audience who got this from the Seattle Times. And this is from the Seattle Times of Thursday, February 6th of 2003. Article by Mike Carter and Ray Rivera of the Seattle Times. It's headlined, "Two Indicted on Espionage Charges Linked to Supremacist Groups." It reads in part, "A former Washington Army National Guard intelligence officer arrested earlier this week on espionage charges had a top-secret clearance and had drifted toward the radical right in recent years, according to sources familiar with the investigation. Rafael Davila, 51, and his ex-wife, Deborah Davila, 46, are suspected of providing white supremacists and other radical organizations with sensitive materials involving the strategic response of the Guard to a variety of emergency situations, both foreign and domestic, according to a Department of Justice source. Military officials confirmed Rafael Davila's clearance level, but would not comment on what information he allegedly provided. The two were arrested Tuesday after a grand jury in Spokane indicted them on unlawful possession of, quote, documents related to the national defense of the United States, unquote, in 1999, the year Rafael Davila retired from the Guard with the rank of major. Rafael Davila is named in a single felony count, while Deborah Davila is named in three counts, including providing false statements to the FBI in April of 2000. Note that the events taking place here were in the run-up to September 11th. According to the indictment, she lied when she told agents she did not know Kirk Lyons, a firebrand North Carolina lawyer who has defended the Ku Klux Klan and White Patriot Party and who has advocated for Southern ethnic cleansing, unquote. Lyons was involved as a defense lawyer on a 1987 trial in Fort Smith, Arkansas, in which Butler, that's Richard Butler, and 10 others were charged with a seditious conspiracy to overthrow the government by acts of violence. All the defendants were acquitted. A federal law enforcement source said some of the national security documents were passed on to Lyons. Lyons has not been charged with a crime. He told the Associated Press he barely knew Deborah Davila, but that she had attended his wedding, which was performed by Aryan Nations founder Richard Butler at the group's former compound near Hayden Lake, Idaho. Several things to note here. First of all, Deborah Davila was at Kirk Lyons' wedding at the heavily guarded, I might add, Aryan Nations compound. You didn't just blow into that particular event. It was not open to the public. We're going to touch on that in a minute. But note that Kirk Lyons was the attorney for Andreas Strassmeyer, according to Carol Howe, Timothy McVeigh's superior in the Oklahoma City conspiracy, and that according to Carol Howe, who passed a lie detector test, that Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bombing was actually masterminded to a considerable extent by Andreas Strassmeyer, who in turn is the son of Gunter Strassmeyer, Helmut Kohl's chief of staff and the de facto architect of German reunification, and also the grandson of a charter member of the Nazi Party under Hitler. I would note that the National Alliance, the arguably the most important domestic Nazi group, which publishes the Turner Diaries and Serpent's Walk, both of which we've talked about in the past, is very closely linked with the NPD, the top German neo-Nazi party, which in turn is linked to people like Horst Mahler and to Ahmed Huber, two of the fellow travelers, or in Ahmed Huber's case, a principal operative of the Al-Taqwa/Muslim Brotherhood Islamo-Fascist milieu. Now, one of the things that I want to note about the documents that were being passed to Kirk Lyons, according to this article, it says that the Davilas are suspected of providing white supremacists and other radical organizations with sensitive materials involving the strategic response of the Guard to a variety of emergency situations, both foreign and domestic, according to a Department of Justice source. And note that this was in the run-up to September 11th. It'd be interesting to contemplate whether, in addition to the obvious danger that Islamist terrorists represent, and the fact that the Bush administration's powerful petroleum connections on the one hand, and its history of involvement with fascism, dating all the way back to the pre-World War II period, running up to the development of the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, a repository for fascist elements dating back to World War II, and more recently, as we looked at in For the Record 356 and 357, a repository for Islamo-fascist elements, including many connected to the Al-Taqwa milieu. We're going to turn now briefly to the book The Beast Reawakens by Martin A. Lee. This is published in hardcover by Little Brown, and we're going to read about Kirk Lyon's wedding. Bear in mind that this was at the Aryan Nation's compound, which was very, very heavily guarded. And it was at this wedding that Ms. Davila was present. And you didn't just walk into this particular gig. Reading from Martin A. Lee's book, Kirk Lyons, an attorney from Texas who defended a rogues gallery of neo-Nazis and white supremacists, tied the knot at the Aryan Nation's encampment in September of 1990. It was actually a Scottish-style double wedding with kilts and bagpipes. Lyons and his friend Neil Payne married two sisters, Brenna and Beth Tate, respectively. Their brother, David Tate, was then in prison for murdering a Missouri State Highway patrolman. David had been a member of the Order, a terrorist offshoot of the Aryan Nations that embarked upon a spree of bank heists and killings in the United States during the early 1980s. Tate had participated in several commando raids against armored cars before the police caught up with him. Otherwise known as Die Bruderschweigen, German for the Silent Brotherhood, the Order was led by a young neo-Nazi zealot named Robert J. Matthews, who recruited followers when he frequented the Aryan Nations headquarters. Matthews fancied himself a latter-day Robin Hood who robbed from the Jews and gave to the Aryans. Using stolen money and counterfeit bills, he waged a campaign of terror modeled after the Turner Diaries, a novel that described a successful paramilitary insurgency by white supremacists in the United States. Again, I want to remind people, first of all, of the fact that Kirk Lyons was Andreas Strassmeyer's attorney. He visited the parents of Andreas Strassmeyer in 1991. It was Kirk Lyons who brought Andreas Strassmeyer to Elohim City, where a fair amount of the Oklahoma City planning took place. The Turner Diaries, again published by the National Alliance's publishing arm, was the model for Timothy McVeigh and Company. And I would also note that as we looked at in For the Record program number 40, available for download from WFMU, according to Edgar Martinez, or Martinez as he called himself, an FBI infiltrator into the order was financed by German, quote, families, unquote, in Latin America. One wonders whether the Thiessens, business partners of the Bush family going back many years, might have been among those families. Now, in connection with the pincers movement that I'm suggesting here, Islamist or Islamo-fascist terror from without, domestic white supremacist terror from within, with the common goal of wiping out Jews, and in the case of at least the white supremacists, non-whites, and destroying the United States, if not completely wiping it out, certainly destroying it to the point where it would no longer be a world power. And I would suggest that the controlling hand, the whip hand, in manipulating these various portions of seemingly disparate or even hostile elements is the virtual state of the underground Reich. Important article was researched for us also by a listener. This is from the New York Times of March 6th of 2003. This article is by Kathleen Rowley, the FBI whistleblower, who tried to alert the Bureau to the danger posed by the Islamist organizers who were already being reported by a number of FBI field agents. And this refers to Ms. Rowley's claim that, in fact, the United States remains vulnerable to terrorist incidents that might be attendant on an invasion of Iraq. And I want to note in particular her observations here concerning Zaharias Moussaoui, the accused 20th hijacker, and his and Mohammed Atta's interest in crop dusters. That's very, very interesting indeed for reasons we're going to develop further here. I also want to note for people that looming in the background of many of these things are people connected in one way or another to François Genoux, one of the most important Nazi operatives before, during, and after World War II, closely connected to the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, the heir to the literary works of Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels, and a person with, as I like to say, more connections than a switchboard, connections running to the milieu of Alan Dulles, of Hjalmar Schacht, elements connected to the far left, to the Islamo-fascist movement. The common uniting goal of many of the elements associated with François Genoux, far right, far left, and Islamist, is hatred of the United States and also, to a somewhat lesser extent, anti-Semitism. Note that Zaharias Moussaoui's French attorney is a woman named Isabelle Coutant-Père, who not only is going to be marrying Carlos the Jackal, another close associate of François Genoux, but who is a law partner of Jacques Vergès, the attorney for Klaus Barbie, and a major Genoux protégé. Again, research credit on this to a listener, New York Times, March 6, 2003, article by Philip Sheenan, Agent Who Saw 9/11 Lapses Still Faults FBI on Terror. It reads in part as follows. The veteran FBI agent who exposed the Bureau's failure to heed evidence of terrorist plots before the September 11th attacks is now warning her superiors that the Bureau is not prepared to deal with new terrorist strikes that she and many colleagues fear would result from an American war with Iraq. The agent, Colleen Rowley of the Bureau's Minneapolis field office, is not a counterterrorism specialist and does not have access to detailed information about Al-Qaeda and its planning. But she is a 22-year FBI veteran who is intimately acquainted with the Bureau's inner workings and with the thinking of fellow agents, including agents who specialize in counterterrorism. In a letter last week to the FBI director, Robert S. Mueller III, Ms. Rowley said that he had responsibility to warn the White House that the Bureau would not be able to, quote, stem the flood of terrorism that will likely head our way in the wake of an attack on Iraq, unquote. Ms. Rowley created an uproar last year when she revealed how in the weeks before the September 11th attacks, Bureau supervisors in Washington had blocked Minneapolis agents who wanted authority for a broader investigation of Zaharias Moussaoui, who has since been indicted as a conspirator in the attacks. She said that many of her colleagues share her view that an American invasion of Iraq would result in a wave of new domestic terrorist attacks by Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups, and that the FBI was ill-prepared to deal with the new threat. In her letter, Ms. Rowley said she believed that the Bureau was continuing to mishandle domestic counterterrorism investigations, including its follow-up to the arrests of Mr. Moussaoui and Richard Reed, the confessed Al-Qaeda terrorist who tried to blow up a transatlantic flight with explosives hidden in his shoes in December of 2001. By the way, I would note that Robert Mueller, as we talked about in For the Record 310, For the Record 349, and also in For the Record number 325, Robert Mueller was in charge of the BCCI investigation and as in that capacity was, shall we say, less than vigorous. You investigate the BCCI investigation, you go directly to the milieu of Al-Qaeda, to the Saudi elite, and to the Bush family, and to the milieu of Talat Otman, a director of Bush's Harkin Energy, who interceded on behalf of the targets of the Operation Green Quest raids of 3/20/2002, interceded, by the way, with the former Secretary of the Treasury Paul O'Neill, who was not in office for a year, who was out of office within a year of that punitive meeting by Talat Otman. That discussed in, by the way, For the Record 356 and in number 376. Skipping down in this article and talking about the interest of Mohammed Atta and Zaharias Moussaoui in crop dusting planes, we read, quote, this is an excerpt from Ms. Rowley's letter. It therefore appears that the government may have sacrificed the possibility of acquiring information pertinent to future attacks in order to conduct criminal prosecution of these two individuals, meaning Zaharias Moussaoui and Robert Reed. She wrote, again quoting, although prosecution serves worthy purposes, including deterrence, standard practice in Organized Crime Terrorism 101 dictates imaginative, concerted attempts to make inroads into well-organized, cohesive groups. And sometimes that requires, quote, dealing with the devil, unquote. Again, quoting, lack of follow-through with regard to Moussaoui and Reed gives a hollow ring to our top priority, unquote, i.e. preventing another terrorist attack, she wrote. Moussaoui almost certainly would know of other Al-Qaeda contacts, possibly in the U.S., and would also be able to alert us to the motive behind his and Mohammed Atta's interest in crop dusting, unquote. Law enforcement officials have speculated that Mr. Atta, the ringleader of the September 11th attack, sought information on crop dusting planes in hope of using one to disperse chemical or biological weapons. And that's obviously a possibility. Let me briefly review yet another possibility. Reading now from the Turner Diaries, this from the Barricade Books edition, ISBN number 1-56980-086-3. The climactic episode of the Turner Diaries is a low-level suicide aerial attack with a crop duster plane, in this case involving nukes. The Earl Turner character is the I talking here. I conferred privately with Major Williams of Washington Field Command for more than an hour on the problem of attacking the Pentagon. The military's other major command centers were either knocked out on September 8th or subsequently consolidated with the Pentagon, which the top brass apparently regard as impregnable. And it damn near is. We went over every possibility we could think of, and we came up with no really convincing plan except perhaps one. That is to make an air delivery of a bomb. In the massive ring of defenses around the Pentagon, there's a great deal of anti-aircraft firepower, but we decided that a small plane flying just above the ground might be able to get through the three-mile gauntlet with one of our 60-kiloton warheads. One factor in favor of such an attempt is that we have never before used aircraft in such a way, and we might hope to catch the anti-aircraft crews off their guard. Although the military is guarding all civil airfields, it just happens that we have an old crop duster stashed in a barn only a few miles from here. My immediate assignment is to prepare a detailed plan for an aerial attack on the Pentagon by next Monday. We must make a final decision at that time and then act without further delay. In the last diary entry from November 9th of 1993, it's still 3 hours until first light and all systems are go. I'll use the time to write a few pages. My last diary entry. Then it's a one-way trip to the Pentagon for me. The warhead is strapped into the front seat of the old Stearman and rigged to detonate either on impact or when I flip a switch in the back seat. Hopefully, I'll be able to manage a low-level airburst directly over the center of the Pentagon. Failing that, I'll at least try to fly as close as I can before I'm shot down. It's been more than 4 years since I've flown, but I've thoroughly familiarized myself with the Stearman cockpit and been briefed on the plane's peculiarities. I don't anticipate any piloting problems. The barn hangar here is only 8 miles from the Pentagon. We'll thoroughly warm up the engine in the barn, and when the door is opened, I'll go like a bat out of hell straight for the Pentagon at an altitude of about 50 feet. Note that obviously in addition to spreading crop dusters, either chemicals or BW weapons, crop dusters can fly very, very low, and they're very sturdy airplanes as well. We'll continue with this line of inquiry in the second side of the program. The For the Record program is being archived by WFMU. Recent programs streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older shows at a longer URL for download only. That is linked to both the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website and to the For the Record section of the Real Audio Equipped Spitfire website at SpitfireList.com. Within a week or so of the airing of this program, there will be a detailed, annotated article-length description of For the Record program number 402 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record 402, Pincers Movement, being recorded on March 9th of 2003. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.